I want to welcome everyone this evening. My name is Peter Tribowitz. I teach in the International Relations Department here and head up the U.S. Center at the LSC, which is sponsoring tonight's lecture on American politics, the gift that keeps on giving. So one of the things that the U.S. Center tries to do is our goal here at the LSC and in London is to try to promote deeper understanding about American politics and society, and I think, you know, everyone would agree we need that right now. And fortunately, we have Thomas Frank with us tonight, someone who's well-versed in the dynamics of American politics and especially kind of conservative and liberal party politics. He's a historian, a political analyst, a journalist, the author of 9 books, including his most recent, Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And that's what he's here to talk about tonight. But before he does, just a few biographical facts, courtesy of that font of all wisdom, Wikipedia. You have a very good page up there. I don't know whether you
it's
know
filled
that.
With lies.
Right. Well, no, Tom was born and bred in Kansas City. That's true.
True.
Why does that matter? Well, there's Dorothy and Toto, but there's also what's the matter with Kansas, how conservatives won the heart of America, which was his blockbuster in 2004. He's a former columnist for the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Harper's. He's currently writes for The Guardian and is also the founding editor of The Baffler. He attended the University of Kansas and University of Virginia as an undergraduate and then went on to get his PhD in history at the University of Chicago. So let's see, for those of you who are on Twitter tonight, the suggested hashtag is LSEUSDems. That makes sense. And for those interested, Listen Liberal will be available for purchase after the talk. So, you know, afterwards what Tom will do is go outside and be available for signing. Let me see, a couple other housekeeping notes. Oh, yeah, before I forget, you need to put your phones to silent because this is being recorded, and if there's too many interruptions, they don't upload the podcast. So with that, please join me in giving Tom Frank a warm LSE welcome.
So how are you all doing tonight? It is so awesome to be here in England. Okay, so let's start with the word that's on everybody's minds, which is Trump. Donald Trump. Everyone is fascinated by this guy. If you go on the Washington Post website, or if you went on it any time in the last 6 months, every one of the top 5 most read stories, there's always some aspect of Trump, Trumpiana, always some bit of Trumpiana. It's all anybody wants to talk about. What made this guy possible? Now that it looks like the guy, everybody's running for the exits, Paul Ryan, finally. Did you see this morning, Glenn Beck? Glenn Beck has more or less endorsed Hillary Clinton.
On moral grounds.
Say it again.
On moral grounds.
On moral grounds. I know the world is upside down. The America's leading conspiracy theorist has abandoned ship. What the hell is going on? Look, but even so, I mean, the Trump movement and the Trump moment are still, this is what people are going to be talking about for years to come when they talk about American politics, you know. And right now, there still is a small chance that this guy will be the next president. Let's think for a second about what an unlikely presidential candidate this guy is, right? No political experience at all.
This is a man who thinks that the way you run for the presidency is going by going down a list of ethnic groups and insulting each one of them in turn, you know, and then cross-insulting them by other categories until everybody is insulted in at least one way or the other. He talks constantly about representing working Americans, but he himself knows very little about their situation since, of course, he hails from the upper reaches of the American plutocracy and, in fact, became famous. You know this? Became famous in America firing people on TV. He hosted this TV show where it was a reality TV show, and at the climactic moment, they'd bring somebody into a room to be fired by him, and the person would plead, you know, oh, no, Mr. Trump, no, Mr. Trump, no, Mr. Trump, and then he'd go, you're fired. Right? And that was his show. And it's like now he is a working class hero. The dude is profoundly unpopular, I mean hated even, by many Americans. And the only reason he even has a chance is because, I mean, let's face it, the Democratic candidate is hated as well. I mean, these are the two most unpopular presidential candidates since, you know, since we figured out how to measure unpopularity. Right? Running one against the other. I mean, what are the chances of that? Not just one party nominating a profoundly unpopular candidate, but both of them doing so simultaneously. Right? And both of these people running entirely negative campaigns. Right? So Hillary's, the Democratic campaign is all about you can't let Trump into the Oval Office. And Trump's campaign, they're chanting, lock her up! Lock her up! Right? Remember Trump's boast in the last debate? You'd be in jail if he was president, is what he said to Hillary. It's the most incredible thing. And here's the weird thing, okay? Everybody hates these two candidates, and yet the candidates' families are personal friends. Chelsea and Ivanka, Bill Clinton and the Donald. Have you seen these pictures of these two guys, you know, tomcatting around back in the 1990s? They are friends. It's the craziest thing. Everybody in the country hates one of them or the other. And they're friends. She went to his wedding. He gave money to her Senate campaigns. Now, of course, the contrasts, right? One of these two deeply unpopular candidates was the unanimous choice, or nearly unanimous choice, of her party's apparatus, while Trump, of course, went against the Republican hierarchy all the way. Hillary Clinton is a longtime Washington professional. She knows the ropes. She knows how it works. She was Secretary of State, for Pete's sake, right? U.S. Senator, First Lady, all through the 1990s. Trump seems to have no idea how it works, isn't even really sure what's in the Constitution and what isn't. You know, Hillary is so polished, so careful to never offend anybody. Trump does nothing but offend. Hillary knows all about how a political campaign is supposed to be run. You know, you reach out to this group and you court these people over here and you focus on the swing states and you do the big data and the micro-targeting and you manage the press and you run your ground game and you do all of this stuff, get people out to the polls on election day. And Trump has no idea about any of this, right? He thinks it's just some kind of celebrity popularity contest. He just says whatever comes to mind, you know, whatever goes through the Facebook feed of his consciousness. And it's all, in his mind, some kind of celebrity showdown with the results that will be determined by everyone dialing in 1-800-MAKE-ME-PRESIDENT or something. Okay, that's an American joke. But listen, folks, this election ought to be, by all rights, by every conventional standard, this should be a complete blowout. I mean, a landslide in the making. And yet, it's still within about 10 points, even after the latest incredible round of scandals. I mean, I can't get over the fact that Trump will win any state at all. And he's going to win my home state of Kansas, you know, the most moral place in America, probably the most moral place on earth. And this guy's going to win it. Let alone that he might win the whole... I mean, there's a chance that he could win the whole thing, right? Now, weirdest of all, the reason that he has done so well, and he was ahead in the polls at one time, and the reason he's done so well is because, now remember, a billionaire who is famous for firing people, the reason he did so well is because he won this enthusiastic support from the white working class, a demographic group that is watching its way of life fall apart before its eyes. Now, once upon a time, this group was not just democratic, you know, a part of the Democratic coalition, but profoundly democratic back in the day. I mean, the needs and desires of the working class were what made the Democratic Party what it is or what it was. I mean, serving working people is why you had a Democratic Party. This is why you had a New Deal back in the 1930s. This is why Franklin Roosevelt won four terms in a row back in those days. And now these people are lining up with billionaire Donald Trump. What the hell is going on? How did this ever come to pass? So, I mean, okay, but today I want to reframe that question just a little bit. I want to ask how, I want to look at those followers. How is it that all of these working class Americans decided to support this character? And how did the Democrats lose the favor of this particular demographic group? Because I think that the degree to which the Republicans have won these people over is the same degree to which the Democrats have abandoned them. Okay? And this is the year to ask, whatever happened to the party of the people? Now, I mean this question in two ways, okay? First of all, how did the Democrats, as I said before, come to abandon working people, you know, the great middle class of America, the people that our politicians used to always talk about? You know, everybody hailed the great middle class, and Democrats have basically walked away. And in a related point, why have they failed to respond to the greatest issue of our time? Now, what do I mean by that? What is the greatest issue of our time? Well, Barack Obama himself has said, and I agree with him, that inequality is the defining challenge of our time. And it's a sweeping statement that he made, but you think about it for a couple of seconds and you realize it isn't anywhere near sweeping enough. This word, inequality, I'm not a fan of it. I think it's a euphemism. I think it's unnecessarily, you know, it's very economic. Well, we're here at LSE. We can have economic sort of terms. But it's a shorthand. Okay, let's talk about what inequality is. It's a shorthand for the things that have gone to make the lives of the rich so much more delicious year on year for the last three decades. And at the same time, it stands for all the things that have made the lives of working people so wretched and so precarious. Inequality. It is visible in the ever-rising cost of health care in the United States, and the cost of university, in the coronation of Wall Street, and the slow blighting of so many other parts of the country. You catch a glimpse of inequality every time you hear about someone who had to declare bankruptcy when one of their kids got sick. This is a very common thing in the United States. Or when you read about the lobbying industry that runs Washington, D.C., or the new, apparently, you know, constitutional requirement we have that our presidential candidates either be billionaires' favorites or billionaires themselves. Inequality is about the way that speculators and even criminals get a helping hand from Uncle Sam while the Vietnam vet down the street from you loses his house. Inequality is the reason that some people find such incredible significance in the ceiling height of an entrance foyer or the hop content of a beer, while other people will never believe in anything again. Inequality, folks, is a euphemism for the Appalachification of our world. Now, I know that it's the Republican Party that bears primary responsibility for this modern plutocracy that we're living in. I know this. I've written book after book after book about it. These are the guys that launched us on this modern era of tax cutting and wage suppressing. These are the ones that made a religion out of the free market and fought so ferociously to open up our politics to the influence of money at every possible level. But just blaming the Republicans one more time, you know, opening up the New York Times op-ed page, folks, this is not good enough, not any longer. Because the things I'm describing, the things that we talk about when we talk about inequality, represent a failure of the Democratic Party as well. Look, protecting the middle-class society was once upon a time the Democrats' traditional mission. And you take a guy like Harry Truman or Lyndon Johnson, one of these sort of old-school Democrats, and they would have known exactly what to do about the situation that we're currently in. Now, I know that these guys had all sorts of things wrong with them. You know, the Vietnam War. Yes, I know all about this. These guys were screwed up in all sorts of ways. But one thing they were really, really, really good at doing was protecting the middle class. And it's true that to this day, Democrats still give lip service to the ideal. You know, they talk a good game about raising the taxes of the rich and so on. But when it comes to tackling the defining challenge of our time, as Obama put it, many of our modern Democratic leaders falter. And they acknowledge that inequality is rampant and awful, and they cry big, fat tears about it. But they can't find the conviction or the imagination to do what is necessary to reverse it. And instead, they offer the same, they dish out the same kind of high-minded policy platitudes that they have been serving up since the 1980s, right? They remind us that there's nothing anybody can do, right? Nothing you can do about technology. Nothing you can do about globalization, right? That's the hand of God reaching down into human affairs and rearranging our world as the Almighty sees fit. Nothing you can do about that stuff. And so they promise us charter schools. Y'all know what this is? Charter schools. And, you know, more job training. And they will shovel out the student loans. Oh, yeah. But other than that, folks, they got nothing. I want to talk about the issue of the Wall Street bailouts back in 2009, which I think is the great historical turning point of our dumb century, you know, such as it is. We're in year 15 here, 16 of our century. And this is the great crisis, the inflection point where my country and the whole world could really have changed course, where the opportunity was there. But our leaders chose not to. Okay, think back to 2008, if you can. I remember how President Obama was elected in this massive wave of hope and enthusiasm. And I was one of the hopeful ones. I was one of the enthusiastic ones. And then, you know, he became president and proceeded to continue the policies of the Bush administration essentially unchanged, at least as regards the banks, for the first 2 years. No big banks ever got put into receivership. Lots of little banks have been, but none of the big banks in America. None of the bailouts were unwound. No elite bankers were ever prosecuted to this day. So Obama and his Democrats refused to change course when all of the signs were telling them to turn, when it would have been good policy for the nation to change course, when it would have been overwhelmingly popular to turn, when the country fully expected them to turn. When I say the country, I mean I'm including Wall Street bankers, totally thought they were going to be taken to the woodshed when he came in, and it didn't happen. And lastly, when it was completely, and this is important, when it was completely within his power to steer the country in a different direction. Okay? It's not, he doesn't have that power anymore, but he sure had it back in 2009. So, what I'm saying is that on this matter, now look, we've just come through a primary campaign in the Democratic Party. We're often told it was idealism versus pragmatism, right? Bernie Sanders was this idealistic figure. Hillary Clinton was the figure of practicality, getting things done. You know, she knows how it's done. Well, on this matter of the Wall Street banks, there was no conflict between pragmatism and idealism. The idealistic thing was also the practical thing and the healthful thing and the popular thing. And they chose not to do it. Now, I know that Democrats are the good guys in our system, or rather the less bad guys. But it is not a coincidence, you know, once you set out this policy on the vis-a-vis Wall Street, it's not a coincidence that almost all the economic gains of the recovery that we've had since then have gone to the already wealthy. And this is not only because sinister Republicans keep thwarting the righteous liberal will. I know how bad Republicans are. I know how awful they are. They play for keeps. They're very good at the game, constantly, playing scorched earth, obstructing. I know. They do that all the time. But what I'm describing here is a straight-up liberal failure. Barack Obama played this issue the way he did, folks, because that's how he wanted to play it. And we have to get our heads around this. Now, I call this a failure, but you know what the correct word for it is, right? This is a betrayal. And the history of this betrayal goes back a long way. It doesn't start with Barack Obama. When I was a kid back in the 70s and the 80s, I used to, you know, read the newspaper, and you'd read about how the Democratic Party was engaged in these sort of constant war with themselves, all this constant infighting within the Democratic Party, always grappling with its identity, arguing over who they were and what they stood for all through those decades, right up into the 1990s. You had all of these different factions in the Democratic Party fighting like cats and dogs, right? But they, one thing they all agreed upon was that the Democrats had to turn away from the legacy of the New Deal and its fixation on working class people. Okay, they fought over every other aspect of what the Democratic Party was going to be, but that one thing, everybody agreed on that. You can't be the party of the New Deal any longer. Now, the man who brought closure to that long-running Democratic Civil War was, of course, President Bill Clinton, who brought a new kind of Democratic administration to Washington, D.C. And I think that if we want to understand how we got to this period with Trump, with Hillary, all of this stuff going on, if we want to understand how we came to this pass, this is the period that we have to look at, the years of the Bill Clinton administration. Now, Clinton did a very interesting thing. He comes to Washington, and rather than doing what every Democrat before him had done, which is pay homage to the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, Clinton did the opposite. He did these kind of amazing favors for Roosevelt's old enemies, for the networks, the power companies, the bankers, the bosses, basically. He deregulated Wall Street. I'm talking about, and it wasn't just one thing at the end of the Clinton administration. There were many, 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 many bank deregulation measures throughout his presidency. He, among other things, ensured that derivative securities would be traded without supervision of any kind, which is an amazing thing when you think about it, but they got that done. He deregulated radio, deregulated telecoms, and he basically put an end to the federal welfare system in the United States, which is an extraordinary thing. In 1997, people don't know this, but in 1997, he also arrived at a secret deal with Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich to privatize the Social Security system. It was secret at the time. It's all come out since then. People have written about it, interviewed the various principals, and it happened. They had a deal. You know, they shook hands. They had it planned out how they were going to do it. They, you know, figured out the timetable, what the end results were going to be. Clinton even did the first speech on the subject, his State of the Union address in 1998. And then it was all derailed by Monica Lewinsky. She is the savior of Social Security. I give thanks for her every day. I have two parents who are, you know, collecting Social Security, and it's a great thing. Now, Clinton is a fascinating president. He had a strategy as a candidate in 1992 when he was running for the presidency where he would go out of his way to insult or distance himself from some traditional Democratic constituency and thus, in this way, assure the public that he was beholden to no one, right, that he was his own man. The most famous example of this you might remember was when he contrived to insult Jesse Jackson before the TV cameras of the nation, you know, insult him to his face while the cameras were rolling. This was the so-called Sister Soldier moment. Does anybody remember this? This is, and the logic that the Clintons had back in those days was that groups like black voters or any of these other groups that he managed to insult, that these groups had, in the popular phrase of the time, nowhere else to go. Okay, this is sort of the logic of Clintonism. You can do whatever you want to these people because they got nowhere else to go. And what's really weird is that this doesn't end with his campaign. He becomes president, and this strategy morphs into basically a philosophy of governance for this guy, right? Body slamming the very people that had just got you elected. Classic example here is the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. It's, you know, highly controversial to this day. This is what is the wind in Trump's sails, such as they are. Anyhow, this, you know what NAFTA was? It was a Republican trade deal that couldn't get through Congress because Congress was controlled by your old school Democrats. Clinton comes in, sets up a war room, puts Rahm Emanuel on the job, and he gets it done. Organized labor, you know, puts everything into fighting Bill Clinton, the man that they just elected. In order to, but he does it. He gets NAFTA done. Okay. Now, when he did this, this is fascinating. He wasn't just insulting a constituent group, organized labor. He wasn't just insulting these guys. Folks, he was conniving in their ruin. Okay? He was doing his part to destroy their economic power. He was doing his part to undermine his own party's greatest ally, right? To ensure that in any kind of showdown between management and labor anywhere in America, virtually anywhere in any kind of manufacturing enterprise and all sorts of other places now, that management would have the upper hand. Because they got the atom bomb now. They can always say, oh yeah, we're moving the plant to Mexico. Any kind of grievance, you know, you want to organize a union, you want to go on strike, maybe you're complaining about dirty bathrooms, whatever it is, we're moving to Mexico. And they do it all the time. There's statistics on this. Once NAFTA is passed, management starts using the atom bomb threat constantly. And labor has no way of retaliating, of course. And sometimes they even follow through on this, right? So as we know, sometimes they do. Sometimes they do actually move the plant. Now, NAFTA is a fascinating issue in all sorts of ways, but one way that I want to focus on here for a second is that this NAFTA is as close to a straight-up class issue as we ever see in the United States. And it gives you an idea about who our modern Democratic Party really cares about, okay? Think about who was in favor of it and who was opposed back in 1993, right? You had professionals and the rich on one side of the question, and you had working people on the other. And it was also not just a class divide, but an educational divide, which is basically another way of saying the same thing. But people with graduate degrees were always, you know, in favor of NAFTA. And you had what has since become very typical of these sort of treaties, which is mass signing of open letters in favor of it by a whole bunch of economists. In this case, it was 283 economists signing a statement that says that the treaty is going to, boost employment and exports and, you know, growth in America and that sort of thing. Now, ironically or disastrously or however you want to put it, the predictions of the unlettered blue-collar workers who opposed NAFTA turned out to be far closer to what actually came to pass than did the rosy scenarios of those economists and the Rhodes Scholar, who was then sitting in the Oval Office. Now, another interesting thing. Clinton's friends, Clinton's fans, you know, the New Democrats, you all know who the New Democrats were. This was his faction within the Democratic Party. And they weren't sorry for NAFTA, and they weren't apologetic about NAFTA, and they didn't really care about the effects that it had. They thought the opposite. This is the greatest thing Bill Clinton has ever done. This is his finest hour, they used to say. It was like Churchillian, right? This is Bill Clinton doing this wonderful thing. And there's a biography of Clinton that came out for the campaign in 1996 that has a similar view about the first term of his presidency. And the author says, this is an admirer of Clinton, big admirer of Clinton, thinks he should be reelected. He's a fine man. And he says that he admits that Clinton has a few faults, but he says that these were in the end balanced and even outweighed by his part in finally sinking the untenable old consensus of the New Deal and the crafting of a new one. Folks, that's why they liked him, because he killed the New Deal, okay? That's why his fans liked him. That's what his admirers admired about this guy. Okay, the new consensus that Clinton crafted. What did he mean by that? What is this new consensus? Well, the same Democratic thinkers who were always advising the party to turn away from workers and the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt had an answer to that question. What Democrats had to embrace, they used to say back in those days, was the emerging post-industrial economy. And the people that the Democratic Party needed to identify with, and this is important here, were the winners in this new economic order, the highly educated professionals who populated our innovative knowledge industries. And when I say professionals, you know, your standard professions, lawyers, doctors, engineers, clergy, that sort of thing. But also, by the 1990s, the category of professionals is exploding, and it includes all sorts of other groups, like math PhDs who write derivative securities on Wall Street, biochemists who make prescription drugs, you know, at Big Pharma in Boston. And once upon a time, this category of Americans, professionals, were solid Republicans. Back in the Eisenhower era, they were one of the most Republican groups in America. Today, they're one of the most Democratic. They've completely shifted. And the Clinton administration is sort of the key era in this change. And that's who the Democrats are to this day. They're the party of the highly educated professional class. And they still have these other constituencies, as we know, minorities, women, labor, the young. But, you know, they have this term for them, right? The coalition of the ascendant. We can talk about that later. But in this coalition, professionals are always the ones who come first. This is the group that matters the most. These are the people whose technocratic outlook always tends to prevail. And it's their tastes and their manners that are always celebrated by liberal newspapers. And it's their particular way of regarding the world that is taken for granted by liberals as being objectively true. So what I'm saying is that professionals dominate the Democratic Party and liberalism these days in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominate Barack Obama's cabinet. You know, it's all these Harvard guys. You know that story. Democrats over the years have developed all of these wonderful, flattering phrases for their favorite demographic, you know, all these lovely terms of endearment. They call these guys the wired workers, right, who are going to inherit the future. They're supposed to be a learning class that truly gets the power of education. And by the way, I love that one, the learning class, right? Some people are in the working class, but other people are in the learning class, right? They're supposed to be, and you've heard this one, a creative class that naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. An innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new stuff, right? And Democratic leaders themselves are, of course, always drawn, well, almost exclusively, from the ranks of this same group, right? It's not a coincidence, folks, that both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, they have the same sort of life trajectory. They're both plucked from this obscure life by some prestigious educational institution somewhere, and then the gates of the world open up to them. Think about Bill Clinton's life, right? He's this kid in Hot Springs, Arkansas. He goes to Georgetown University, becomes a Rhodes Scholar, right? Goes to Yale Law School, where he meets Hillary Clinton, late of Wellesley College, right? Or Barack Obama, who goes to Columbia and Harvard Law School, becomes president of the Harvard Law Review. It's always the same story with these guys, and you look at their cabinet choices, and it's always the same thing, right? All of these successful professionals whose worth is established by their achievements in college and graduate school. So let me summarize the kind of reverse Marxism that I'm talking about here. This class of people are thought to be, by democratic theorists, the heroes of history, right? These are the people standing at the very end of the historical dialectic, according to these guys. These are the winners. And they are also, they just happen to be, the number one constituency of the Democratic Party. And all of our recent Democratic leaders happen to be drawn from the ranks of this very same group. So this shift that I'm describing from your traditional working class to the professional class is what explains so much that is frustrating about our modern-day Democrats. This is, to go back to the problem that I started with, this vexing historical question of Barack Obama and the Wall Street banks. Why is it that the Obama team failed to do what needed to be done with these guys on Wall Street? Why did they declare that Wall Street executives were going to be held to a different legal standard than ordinary criminals? And they did declare that. The guy who said it had to resign, you know, a few days later, but he said it, right? Why did the Obama team choose Wall Street over average Americans again and again and again and again? Well, folks, the answer is obvious once you think about it in this way, because for the achievement-conscious people who fill the Obama administration, investment bankers are more than friends. These guys are peers. These guys are colleagues. These guys are classmates, right? They go, you know, back and forth through the revolving door, and there is no difference. Treasury Department, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, you know, Council of Economic Advisors, it's all the same thing. You know, they look at Wall Street. The Treasury Department looks at Wall Street, and they see these people with subtle minds. and sophisticated jargon. Oh, they love that shit, right? Sophisticated jargon, right? And extraordinary innovativeness, right? Exactly the kind of creative individuals the Democratic Party theory tells us we have to respect and honor, right? They're making these financial instruments that are so admirably complex. When I was writing this book, I showed the manuscript to a friend of mine who's a bank regulator back in the 70s and 80s. And he had a hand in sending many bank executives to prison in those days, during the SNL scandal, if you remember what that was, if you're old enough. And we were talking about this, and he said that in his day as a bank regulator, when they would see undue financial complexity, they'd be looking over a bank's books or something, and they'd see undue financial complexity, they'd say, aha, they're up to something, fraud. That's a red flag. Let's look closer at that. When the Obama people see complexity, you know what they say, right? Sophistication. It's so wonderful, right? It's financial rocket science, as one Obama administration official once said. And by the way, he said that in the course of explaining why they couldn't prosecute these guys. Sophistication, man. Financial rocket science, we can't understand it, man. It's so beyond us. And this ditto, folks, ditto for big pharma, exact same thing, so innovative. You can't import generic pharmaceuticals. You have to protect these innovative companies. And folks, mega dittos for Silicon Valley, right? An industry that can do virtually no wrong in Democratic eyes. I mean, so lovable. Zuckerberg, so professional, so creative. Right? Eric Schmidt, wonderful people that for this one industry, Silicon Valley, for this one industry, enforcement of my country's antitrust laws has basically been suspended, right? Bow down before Uber, they say. Uber, the company that is rewriting the social contract of America as we speak. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State during President Obama's first term, she used to go around the world. This is hilarious. We never talk about it. She's running for president. We never talk about what her foreign policy was. She used to go around the world proselytizing for something called internet freedom. Do you know what she meant by this? She'd go around the world saying that access to certain Silicon Valley servers, like Google, Facebook, that sort of thing, access to these servers was a basic human right. Okay? That was the foreign policy of my country. So what does a party of the professional class look like? What does it believe in? Well, the most important, you know, the number one item on the, on the list is, of course, meritocracy. The idea that the successful deserve their rewards and that the people on top are up there because they are the best, right? This is the first commandment of the professional class. Everyone gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. Okay? Now, you guys are literate humans. You are, you know, you've read a lot of books and magazine articles, and you know that this is wrong in about 100 different ways, the whole philosophy of meritocracy. But where it is wrongest is as a way of taking on the problem of inequality. Right? This is not a doctrine for mitigating inequality. This is a doctrine for rationalizing inequality, for brushing it off. This is the exact opposite idea. What I want to point out is that there is no solidarity in a meritocracy. Okay? This is the idea that I want you to take away. There is no solidarity in a meritocracy. People at the top of the professional class, like someone at the Treasury Department, somebody at J.P. Morgan, show this incredible deference and respect for one another, the people at the top of their fields. But they feel zero sympathy for their own colleagues who are lower down in the hierarchy. I'll give you an example. Well, if you've ever worked in a white-collar workplace, you know what I'm talking about. When somebody gets fired, they don't band together and go on strike or, you know, present, you know, some demand to the boss, some ultimatum or something like that. They figure he had it coming, right? Or a better example. So I'm a member of this class. I got a PhD back in the mid-90s. And when I got my PhD, I went out on the job. I wanted to be a historian, right? That was my ambition. And I went out on the job market, and I discovered that you couldn't be a tenure-track historian in America anymore. There's a handful of tenure-track openings. Everybody had to work as an adjunct. Do you know what this is? Do they have this over here? This means you work very, very hard for very little pay. And this was happening to my whole generation of people with PhDs in the humanities and the social sciences. I mean, this field has been basically destroyed, you know. The young people coming up with PhDs are finding, I mean, it goes on to this day. Now, there are still plenty of professors, tenured professors, with lots of power in the American academy. How much sympathy do you think they feel for those adjuncts, for their own students with the PhDs who are going out and find it? Zero. The answer is none. Yes, there are good professors here and there, really nice guys who care, but as a class, they don't give a damn. That's because there is no solidarity in a meritocracy, right? That life doesn't shower its blessings on people who can't make the grade isn't a shock or an injustice to them. It's the way things are supposed to be. So this story that I've told you tonight is a happy and inspiring one, I think, in many ways. This is a return to the Victorian era in all its glory. This is the coming together of money and merit. Think about it. This is righteousness coming together with success. This is the marriage of finance with political virtue. And virtue and righteousness are what being a liberal is all about these days in my country. But in another sense, the transformation that I've been describing, the transformation of the Democratic Party, has been a disaster. Now think about it. Left parties all over the world were founded in order to advance the fortunes of working people. But our left party in America has chosen over the last 30 years to turn its back on those people's concerns and make itself instead into the tribune of the enlightened professional class, a creative class that makes fine, innovative things like derivative securities and smartphone apps. And the working people that the Democratic Party used to care about, they figured had nowhere else to go in the famous Clinton-era expression. Folks, look around you. They have found somewhere else to go. By abandoning these people, Democrats have made inevitable both the kind of economic desolation that you see all over my part of the country, as well as a populist backlash against liberalism that has been building for decades now. 12 years ago, I wrote about what it looked like in my home state of Kansas. And today it is all over the country. The backlash is everywhere you go in America now, swarming up out of the deindustrialized zones, screaming its bizarre, ugly, Trumpian slogans. And think about the choice that leaves us with this year. On the one hand, angry right-wing intolerance, and on the other hand, inequality forever. Folks, there has got to be a better way. Thank you very much. Now, they have a whole technique for doing questions, and then I'm going to sign books, and then I'm going to drink beer.
Okay, so I guess that's an invitation to go drink beer with him afterwards.
to buy me beers. We'll talk about that later.
So, thank you very much. I'm going to actually, I didn't tell him this, but I'm going to exercise the privilege of the chair. So I'm going to take the first question. I see your hand, but you'll have to wait. So I take your point. And I have some sympathy for your take on the Clinton years and some for your take on the Obama years. I think the Democrats deserve some of the blame for the hollowing out of the middle class. But I wonder about seems to me that as part of the stories, not maybe underplayed or undervalued or maybe missing. And it has really to do with like the historical and kind of structural context. So let's take Clinton. So when Clinton comes into office, This is after the Republicans have won the presidency three times in a row. The Democrats are on the ropes, and they know it. They can't win the presidency. I mean, the irony is everything is flipped around now. They can't win. Well, maybe they'll win the House. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. Right? Anything could happen this year.
It could happen this year.
But Paul Ryan is running for the exit.
Right, but so it's like a presidential, you know, now they're the party of the presidency, but back then they weren't, because you had Reagan won it twice, and then, and really if you went back and you included the 70s, the Democrats only won it once over the course of the 70s and the 80s and on into the 90s with that interlude with Jimmy Carter, which was a failed presidency. So point number one. Point number two is that Bill Clinton got elected with a plurality vote of 43%. And so he came in kind of weak to begin with, and matters got worse in 94 with the Gingrich Revolution. So the point here is that there was some kind of, just from the standpoint of politics, some kind of structural impediment in a way. And then and the third point on this is, so I think you're right that the Democrats embraced neoliberalism, and I mean I think that that's right, in the 1990s is the right period. But, you know, I'm not totally convinced that they did so believing that they were going to damage the middle and working class. So it's easy to forget the Democrats from FDR through Harry Truman through Jack Kennedy through Lyndon Johnson supported free trade. But they supported free trade at a time when the United States was like the dominant world, you know, dominant in the world economy, and Bill Clinton didn't. And I think, you know, where the United States was beginning to kind of like, you know, lose some traction. And so one wonders if, you know, it's not so much that they knew what they were doing, but that they drank too much of the Kool-Aid.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So I mean, I just, you know, I wonder, and you know, and Clinton was white. I mean, Obama was a black president. I mean, that's like pushing a rock up a hill.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's true that Clinton. I mean, this is Clinton's admirers, if you read the Clinton biographies, and so for writing Listen Liberal, what I read only the sort of pro-Clinton literature. I didn't read the right-wing literature on Clinton, which is completely unhinged. Right. And, you know, they call him a communist, a drug dealer, a murderer. I mean, these insane accusations, right? But I only read the books by his admirers. Right. And that is his great, great, great achievement, is that he got reelected. They think this is, you know, so extraordinary for the fortunes of the Democratic Party. Okay. But there's two important things to remember. First of all, he lost the House of Representatives, which they had held from 1930 up until 1994 with just two little interruptions. That's Clinton's fault, basically. And then second of all, you look at what Clinton actually did as president. You guys ever think about this? What his actual accomplishments were? When we look back now, we're blinded by the impeachment and by the sex scandals and by the good economic times. But if you think about what he actually did as president, there's five things that his admirers are proud of. Okay? NAFTA is the first one. The crime bill of 94 is the second one. Deregulation of banks is the third one. Welfare reform, where he abolished the welfare program in America, is the fourth one. And then the last is he balanced the budget. Four of those five are complete disasters, complete smoking ruins. I mean, NAFTA, this is the deindustrialization of America. The crime bill, this is mass incarceration. And they knew it at the time. The Black Caucus begged him not to do it, and he did it. The deregulation of Wall Street, Jesus Christ. And abolishing welfare, yeah, good idea. It looked good when the economy is in boom times, but now, you know. Anyhow, the important point is that all five of these measures were Republican measures. What Bill Clinton did was consummate the Reagan Revolution. He got things done that the Reagan people couldn't. In fact, there is one of the best quotes in Listen Liberal comes from some internal memo that some researcher found in the Clinton library. But an internal memo from the Clinton years when they one of their many, many, many bank deregulation measures passed, and they said, "We did what Reagan couldn't." Reagan couldn't get it done. The Republicans couldn't get NAFTA done. Welfare reform was a Republican proposal. So was mass incarceration. These were all, but Clinton got them done. This is like, it's awesome. Democratic Party is back. Democratic Party is riding high. They're winning elections. They're winning the presidency. Look what they did with that power. So that's what I, you know, it is right. He did win. He won re-election and he beat the impeachment rap. But look what this guy did, you know, and they're paying for it now. And Clinton himself, there's a new book that just came out. I was just flipping through it before I got on the airplane. NAFTA, which was the first thing he did right out of the gate, just put the knife into the back of his strongest supporters, organized labor. They spent everything they had trying to stop him on it. It's not a coincidence that then the next year, that was in 93, the next year they lose Congress. I mean, after he did this act of betrayal, these people are going to stay home. You know, they're not interested in you anymore. And that's the end. Anyhow.
Well, so let's open it up. So let's take the gentleman back there in the checkered shirt. I'll move around.
Okay. You're taking several or one at a time?
Let's see. How many hands were there up? We can take a few. So we'll start with you, and then we'll go to the woman back there in the green shirt.
My name's David Harrington. I'm a member of the public. I'm quoting from a leader in The Economist this week where it says that Americans, plural, are not very interested in politics. Do you agree or disagree?
So hold on,
I'm interested in nothing else, but that's just me. You know, I live in Washington. It's all we talk about. We're just fascinated by it. And sorry?
Redskins.
Yeah, the football team, yeah. But I think Americans are unusually fascinated by politics this year. You know, because of the Trump phenomenon, everyone, everywhere is talking about Trump. I get off the airplane here and they're talking about him. They can't shut up about him. They're terrified. And but I'll tell you, this is an interesting little historical fact. I mean, you know, Americans don't vote by and large. It's like voter turnout in America is always very low. And it's especially low when I think it'll be low this year when both of the candidates are so despised. You know when voter turnout was highest in American history? This is really interesting. In like the 1870s and 1880s, when there was no difference between the parties, but they thought of politics as a kind of sport. It was like a game that you played, and you lined up with your team, and you went on these parades, and you marched around, and you yelled at the other side, and you had your party newspaper, and it was a big game, and people were really, really, really involved in it. And there was no difference between the parties. You know, it's like Benjamin Harrison, Grover Cleveland. It doesn't make any difference. But it was a blast. You know, people loved it. But now it's, you know, there was a great book a couple of years ago. Well, geez, I'm so old. It's 20 years ago. E.J. Dionne, Why Americans Hate Politics. And people don't vote there anymore. And when you have candidates this bad, they especially don't vote.
Let's take the woman back there with the green shirt. I think we should try to get a couple. Let's see, where some hands over here, right down here. Okay, this woman down here in the black shirt. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You've been very critical of the Democrats and Hillary Clinton, but I'm curious, if you were Hillary's sort of main policy advisor and she won, what five policies do you think she should implement to reverse this trend?
Hold that thought.
Is this okay?
Introduce yourself just briefly.
I'm Taryn, and I'm a grad student here in economics. You briefly mentioned Bernie in his relation to Hillary in the primary, but I'm curious how you think that the Bernie revolution, as it were, and the Trump's candidacy on the Republican side played off each other in terms of whether you think that split the working class that previously would have gone Democrats, or had Trump not existed, would Bernie have done better, and vice versa.
So you have to be like policy advisor first, and then you can be political analyst.
About Bernie.
Well, about the left and the right, but the first question is if you were advising Hillary.
Yeah, yep, I understood that. So what should Hillary do? I mean, a lot of the stuff was out there on the table. The first thing that is for me is so obvious: for if you want to fix inequality, you want to rebuild the Democratic Party, you want to help out ordinary working class Americans, make it possible to form a labor union in America again. I mean, it's impossible today. This is, you know, you try to form a union in your workplace, you're fired. You know, you're fired. And there's nothing. It's against the law to fire people for that. But there's, you know, the law has no teeth. And the unions beg the Democrats every 4 years or 8 years. It's like, please, please, please let us organize unions in America again. And the Democrats are like, we'll get around to it one of these days. It's time to do it. That would change the whole picture if you had an organizing wave in America. And it could happen now. I would do something about college debt. I mean, what we're doing to a generation of young people is just inexcusable. You know, coming out of college, $100,000 in debt. And there's different ways of going at that. You could lean on the colleges to stop constantly raising tuition. Where I went to graduate school, the University of Chicago, cost $60,000 a year right now. $60,000 a year. Think about that, 4 years of that. You know how much that is? $250,000. Who has that much money to spend on a kid's education? Nobody does. Nobody. Maybe the top, tiny sliver of the income distribution. She should do something about antitrust. By the way, and this is something that's totally within her power, whether she has Congress or not. We have antitrust laws in America, but we decided back in the Reagan days to stop enforcing them. And, I mean, you have monopolies all over the place in America, especially these sort of, post-industrial monopolies coming out of Silicon Valley with these incredible schemes for cornering some market in some crazy way that you never thought of. And the answer to that is not to just let it go, and hope that some other competitor comes up, but to look into it and see what the hell is going on. I think she has to get tough with Wall Street. She's never going to, but she has to. She has to get tough with the investment bankers, and that could take any number of different forms. It's not too late to investigate some of these guys, to send the FBI after some of these guys for the wave of fraud that you had in the last decade. It's not too late. It's almost too late.
But before you turn to that question, just to follow on that, let's say that she really whoops him, that somehow...
That she gets Congress?
That she gets Congress, so...
Yeah, you then think, she should. If she does that, she should have some kind of new Glass-Steagall Act, where you separate the industry into different, so that the industry competes with itself. And it's going to be tough to do the things that I mentioned that Obama should have done. He could have done because of the bailout situation that we were in. That's all over now. That opportunity has passed, unfortunately. But there are other things that could be done. Mm. She has to fix health care. I mean, health care in America is just this absolute shabacle. You guys know about this, it bankrupts people every day. It's a disastrous system. So that's enough. So Bernie Sanders, I forget what I'm supposed to say about Bernie. Could he beat Trump? Is that what you're asking?
It seems like people that would have gone to the old Democrats.
Yeah.
Many of them either supported Bernie or supported Trump.
Yeah, yeah. That's happening all over the place.
There's some interplay there. Where yeah.
So I think Bernie would have been against Trump anyways. Now, had the Republicans chosen – I mean, this is all a very complicated chess game. Had the Republicans chosen someone like Marco Rubio, it would have been really hard to beat him. Had they chosen Trump, okay, as they did, Bernie would have cleaned his clock because Bernie is speaking to a lot of the same voters. Bernie would appeal directly to these people that are going for Trump, but in a less toxic way. You know what I mean? Like a non-poisonous way. And I think Bernie would have been a landslide. I think it may well turn out to be that as it is. By the way, I'm criticized all the time for criticizing Hillary in the heat of a presidential campaign, as though that's impermissible. But I think about the Democrats, and it's like, if this is really the fascist threat, if Trump is it, if Trump is the brown shirts on the march, what the hell are they doing choosing Hillary Clinton? Choose somebody who's going to kick his ass, right? Give us Sanders. Give us Joe Biden. The hell, Martin O'Malley. Would whoop this guy. Don't give us someone who's having struggling, and can't turn it on and doesn't know how to do it. Give us, if it's really the fascist threat, take it seriously,
Right down here. We'll take this gentleman down in the front row.
You don't need the microphone. I can hear you.
But they can't necessarily.
Oh, okay.
So
I need more agua.
Yeah. We have plenty of that.
What I find very odd about the U.S. is that people the media, Fox News, can persuade people to vote against their own interests. Something very similar has been happening in this country. With Tony Blair playing a Bill Clinton card. But we've got Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
And he is a sort of Bernie Sanders, except he's way to the left of Bernie Sanders. He's very close to the Communist Party. You know, they want 90% tax rates, nationalization.
Sanders doesn't do any of those things, you know.
And yes, but in UK, it's you know, we've gone to one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
And this, would, do you reckon Sanders would have, you know, given Trump a very hard time?
Yeah, yeah. And so Sanders is, you know, I've heard this comparison a lot since I've been here, and I don't know how far it goes. Sanders does not strike me as a radical or unusual or marginal figure. He strikes me as a very familiar kind of politician. He's a New Dealer. I mean, we have a name for his, or we used to have a name for what he is. He's a New Dealer. He calls himself a socialist. I actually don't know why he does that. He's not a socialist. He's like, he's running on Harry S. Truman's, you know, healthcare plan. You know, the guy is like right out. He's a museum piece, is what he is. By the way, what's fascinating about, I like Bernie Sanders. I did an interview with him in for Salon back in 2014. It was a wonderful, wonderful interview. It was great talking to him. But what's fascinating to me about him is the way the Democratic Party reacted to him. It was like an allergy. It was like, this is something that they thought they had put behind them forever, and here it comes back again, and they're like, they can't stand it. And they united against him in a way I have never seen the Democratic Party do, where every office holder, with a handful of exceptions, like fewer than 10, every office holder was endorsing Hillary. So she had all the superdelegates. The Democratic National Committee, as we know, thanks to those, you know, the hacks, right? The Democratic National Committee was on her side. We know that Obama, there's this big article in Politico magazine, Obama did everything in his power to ensure that she was his hand-picked successor, including he personally talked Biden out of running. He wanted to make sure that she didn't have, you know, that her only challenger was Bernie Sanders, who was thought at the time to be this very weak, you know, easy pushover, right? And then he turned out to not be that. But the Democratic Party hated this guy, hated him. I just wrote a story for Harper's Magazine about the way the Washington Post treated Bernie Sanders' candidacy. Now, you know, this is a whole other story of this election in America right now, is the way the media is reacting to it. I've never seen the media so partisan, to taking sides in the way that they're doing this time. And they even ran a front-page story about it in the New York Times, where the author of the story was saying this is okay because we're facing this real crisis in our democracy, a man who doesn't believe in the sort of American tradition, and so we can do whatever we want. And where the press should enlist on one side or the other of the, obviously on the Hillary side of the partisan war. But what's funny is they did that to Bernie too, even before it was clear that Trump was going to be the Republican nominee. They really came down against this guy, like just stomped on him. Fascinating what's going on in that country. By the way, think about this for a second. You guys have the same question before you here. When you're part of the media and you decide that you're a propagandist because there's this existential threat to democracy itself, when do you go back to being a journalist? You know, because if you listen to some people, they always say there's an existential... People said that about Mitt Romney, you know? Yeah, people said that about John McCain, right? Oh, my God, this is the end of the world! They always say that, you know? How do you make that judgment that this time it's real? This time we really have the brown shirts on the march. There's no answer to this question, you know.
Right down here, this guy.
I'm sorry, I wandered way far away from your... I hope that was okay.
Well, we'll go here, and then I'll come back to you in the back there, right over here. Guy in the striped shirt in the very back.
So the question is, obviously, it's probably a pretty predictable question, but so where does the Republican Party go now? So is it the new... place for change? So does like Paul Ryan / Mitt Romney, do they just become Democrats?
It's
right.
Yeah,
and
that's the
heartland
question.
Just goes Republican. Is that your
yeah?
I know it comes up with a sort of like Ross Douthat sort of New York Times compassion and conservatism type thing.
Hold that thought. One more question there.
Hi, Thomas. I know you've been on this side of the pond for a few days now. What kind of sort of read across do you see from your analysis of the Democrat Party to the state of center-left parties in Western Europe, where centre-left parties across Western Europe are cratering at the moment.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the Republicans first, if you don't mind. So the action is all going to be in the Republican Party in the next, after Trump goes down, and he's going down. I mean, this is, you know, the wheels are off the bus. I mean, it's spectacular to watch. And kind of fun, really. But what's the GOP going to do? They're going to follow I mean, 4 years from now, they're going to be, my thinking is that Hillary's going to be president. Inequality is going to get worse. Everything that I've described, the trajectory is going to continue, okay? Nothing really is going to change. Everything's going to remain the same. 4 years from now, with the situation considerably worse, you're going to have another Trump. Or are you? I mean, the thing is, look at the Republican Party in America. This is a well-honed instrument, you know, maintained by the Koch brothers and Paul Ryan and the, you know, very conservative free market faction of the Republican Party, Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay. Think of all the effort that has gone into making this party the well-oiled weapon that it is. And this guy Trump comes along and wrecks it, you know, in a matter of months, right? He's like, no, we're against free trade now. And, you know, we're going to withdraw from the American empire. And we're not going to, you know, we don't care about the Middle East anymore. And all this stuff he's saying, and they're like, what? You know, what's going to happen in the Republican Party? It's going to be one hell of a battle, right? As the traditional sort of ultra-right free market types fight to reassert their control. But there's also a lot of people that have seen that Trump is the Trump movement. This is how you win the primaries. And so 4 years from now, my prediction is that you'll see a whole flock of Trumpettes, right, or junior Trumps, right? Maybe Ted Cruz will become – I mean, this guy will say anything, right? Maybe he'll become a Trump. You know, maybe Mike Pence will become Trump. But the thing is, think about this for a second. Trumpism minus Trump is powerful stuff. If you were to take Trump's platform, such as it is, and put a real politician in front of it. It's not some idiot that thinks the thing to do is to insult every – it's like, is there a group I haven't insulted yet? You know, like, what kind of fool does that? But you put a real politician there who knows better than that, this thing is going to be hard to stop, okay? And that's – I mean, that's the danger. Or is it they'll just go back to nominating people like Mitt Romney and, you know, fighting their stupid culture wars and, you know, on and on and on into the future. Now, the Democrats, you know, the Democrats really held the line this time. You know, the Democratic Party came together and stopped the insurgency. And I think Hillary, there's not going to be – I used to say there's going to be another Bernie Sanders in 4 years, but I don't think there is. There's no way you unseat the woman who defeated – the first woman president, the woman who defeated Donald Trump. There's no way any Democrat is going to rise up and challenge her 4 years from now, is my feeling. Now, the center-left parties in Europe, I'm really not a great authority on them, but I can say that – everyone that I talk to that has, you know, that knows about this or is involved in this, these are parties that have no sense of purpose any longer, really don't know where they're going or what they're doing or why they exist. And that is the same. I mean, the Democrats in America are – I went to the Democratic convention. These people contradict themselves from minute to minute. So you have a speech about a peace, and then you have a Marine Corps general that comes out and gives like this speech like right out of the movie Patton, you know? Were you guys there? It was incredible. Or you have, Trumka, right? Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, gives his labor speech, and then they go outside and all the delegates are supposed to take Ubers back to the hotel. The Democratic Party has set up a special deal with Uber. You know who this is, right? this is the gig economy in the flesh. And it's like, yeah, you know, he gave that great speech about organized labor. Now go take your Uber back to the hotel. That's how they set it up. These people are, they have lost any sense of who they are. Well, they know who they are. They're righteous because they are the top. They're the best. They're the most educated. They're the best and the brightest. And they know how to manage things. You look at Obama and his inner circle of Harvard people, and they are up there because that's who they are. It is a, God, what's Marx's term? The something something of the ruling class. They're the executive. They're like the executive committee of the not the ruling class, but the, you know, Harvard class of 96 or whatever the hell it is, you know. But anyhow, so they really have lost their purpose. That's my feeling. Now, I'm not an authority on that. That's just what I the sense I get from looking around. They don't know how to stop the far right. They don't know what they're doing. They're without a rudder.
Can I ask you just on the Democratic Party to just push a little on that? So how stable do you think? I mean, because what you have right now is like a coalition, as you put it before. I mean, this portion of it, the kind of professional creative class on the one hand, and then what you have are minorities, African Americans and Hispanics. And so one wonders, like, how stable is that?
With a smart Republican, they could peel that thing apart. I mentioned that I live in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and one of the terms I promised you that I would talk about it some more. One of the terms you hear in D.C. is the coalition of the ascendant. This is how the Democrats describe their coalition. And they think, the Democratic Party, their big thinkers, all believe that they have a lock on the presidency from here to eternity because of the changing demographics in America. They think that, you know, all these groups are growing and these groups are shrinking, and the ones that are growing happen to be our groups, and so we are going to prevail in every national election from here on. Now, this, of course, leaves out the possibility that the Republicans might try something different, which they never take into consideration. But it also gives the Democrats this sense of fatalism and complacency, where everything is always a done deal, you know, and you don't have to try very hard. You don't have to say anything different. You can just count on your constituent groups to turn out the vote, and you're going to win. And there's this feeling of complete complacency about the Hillary Clinton campaign, and of fatalism about Democrats generally. You talk to them about things like gerrymandering, right, where the Republicans they think it's impossible for Barack Obama to have done anything differently as president, that every step was predetermined and fated, and he could never have played his cards in any way differently, you know, because everything, anyhow. They're in the grip of this kind of really pessimistic philosophy that allows them no latitude to change or do anything differently. And they really believe in it. And it's just folly, you know? It's just complete and utter folly. The Republicans are going to kick their ass.
Right down there in the blue shirt, or the two blue shirts, we'll go one light blue, dark blue. Oh
my God. I've been doing this for how many days have I been here? 5 days? And I've been speaking constantly. And I'm going to go home and drink so much bourbon.
I heard you speaking a few months back on the Tom Hartman show, The Right Stuff, being interviewed, The Great Minds. But it was interesting, a couple weeks after that, they had someone who actually tracked the Koch brothers' money, and they'd given up on the presidential race quite a while ago, because I think they're very smart, and they knew that he wasn't going to pull.
They don't like Trump. The Koch brothers hate Trump.
But what they've done with those hundreds of millions of dollars is put them into local elections, but not just state, but local. So, and that's why the Republican Party is going to be so strong, both in Congress, perhaps not in the Senate, but at a local election. And that's going to create, I would think, and you can comment on this, a real gridlock, because they will control what happens at the state level.
Yes, they already do. That's already come to pass. Republicans control the largest number of state legislatures that they have ever controlled right now. I mean, they're at a kind of high water, you know, high flood, or whatever you call it, flood tide of Republicanism at the state level. Their majority in the House of Representatives is one of the biggest they've ever had. And that's right now, you know, with Barack Obama in the White House. And yes, it's in part thanks to the Koch brothers and thanks to these guys really play the game well, the Republican Party. It's funny to say that after their presidential race just completely fell apart. You know, part of the irony of it is they thought this was their year. That's why there were 17 candidates vying for the Republican nomination. They thought they could beat Hillary Clinton easily. And they all wanted to be the next president. And that's why Trump was able to win. But they ordinarily, they're very, very well organized. So, by the way, the story that I tell in What's the Matter with Kansas is, this is a book that I wrote back in 2004, it's similar to that, but it's kind of a real grassroots story. It doesn't involve money from the Koch brothers, but it's about a bunch of working class, blue collar people in places like Wichita and Kansas City, Kansas, and they are they overthrow the local Republican hierarchy, which happened to be professional class people, a lot of lawyers from these prestigious law firms and stuff like that. And they overthrew these guys from the bottom up. They worked their butts off, and they, you know, enlisted in the party, and they handed out literature, and they did all the things that you're supposed to do. And not for the money, because they really, I mean, they did it because they really believed in, like, these various culture war issues. And I disagree with these people on everything, and you can look at what they did, and it's this huge car crash of a you know, political disaster. It's Sam Brownback now in the state of Kansas. I don't know if you know about this, but it's like the worst result you could possibly get from any kind of political revolution. But there was something inspiring about that, about the citizen action, and I would like to see that happen in the Democrats as well. I'd like to see that happen all over the country, and it doesn't necessarily require money. Although, like you said, it is true. The Koch brothers have been incredibly canny players at the political game. God, I need to shut up.
You got to have a little longer.
Hi, I'm Macaulay Pugh, and I'm a master's student here at the LSE, and I've been a lifelong Democrat voter. So I could comment on a lot of the stuff you said tonight, but just one thing that I don't think you really addressed is the actual situation in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, you said of the things that need to be changed in the U.S., if you were Hillary Clinton's advisor, you said college tuition needs to change.
Yeah.
The regulation and monopolies.
Antitrust.
And healthcare. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've been following Congress, and it seems like there's one party that's been trying to change that. The Democrats, for example, a few years ago tried to get a bill through that would have had very minor, just minor changes to the college tuition scheme that we have now. And I think every single Democrat voted for it, and one Republican voted for it, and it lost because the Republicans voted against it.
Oh, I know. I was under the assumption that we were saying that she got Congress, too.
Okay, sure, but like and a few years before, Obamacare passed with every Democrat voting in the Senate.
No, I know. They're complete obstructionists.
I'm not disagreeing, but why would you think that the Democratic Party, I guess, in short, if even with the electoral barrage that came in 2010, when they tried to get a very mediocre healthcare bill passed, the Democrats...
A Republican healthcare bill, by the way. It was an old Republican project from the 90s that they dusted off.
Lots of people have proposed similar
stuff. And the Republicans fought them to the end.
Yeah. So why...
Well, I think
he's got your question.
No, it's a good question. I get this... Yeah. We talk about this all the time. So the Republicans play for keeps, and they play the game really well. And in some ways, I fault Barack Obama for not seeing that they were going to do this. In some ways, he was very gullible. Do you remember the idea of the healthcare fiasco? So where he let – who is that senator from Iowa? Do you remember – who am I talking about? Grassley. He let Chuck Grassley waste time on Obamacare for like months and months and months in the hope of getting this one Republican vote. And then he gives him all of these concessions. You know, here, Mr. Grassley, have this, have this, have this. And then Grassley's like, hey, I'm not going to vote for it. And so what you do then is you immediately take the concessions back, right? It's like, okay, sorry. You know, he didn't do that. And it was like Grassley played Obama. And that was inexcusable in my mind, watching that happen, because I knew, you know, we all know that that's how the Republicans play the game. They are really, really obstructionist. They're these scorched earth kind of people. And another thing, Obama's like, he has Rahm Emanuel standing right next to him through all this. This is the meanest guy in American politics, the toughest, you know, street fighter of a politician in American politics, and he can't see this stuff coming. It astonishes me. But when you go back to judge the Obama administration, and then the grand bargain, you know what this was, where Obama spent 2 years trying to get the Republicans to agree to this great deal where he would raise taxes and they would... No, it's the other way around. They would let him raise taxes, and he would give them cuts in Social Security, right? And it's deeply unpopular with the public, but he wanted it, and he keeps after it, and he keeps after it, and they keep saying no, and it just goes on and on. It's just like, what are you doing, Barack Obama? And but if we want to judge Obama, you know, if we want to see – this is what I tried to do in Listen Liberal, was let's see what Democrats are really like when they are free to act. you know, when there is no obstructionism and there is, you know, none of this stuff. And so I looked at his what he did with Wall Street, where he had almost complete freedom to do whatever he wanted and failed to use it. And then I also looked at how Democrats rule certain states. In particular, I did Massachusetts. And there, you know, this is an overwhelmingly Democratic state. And the way that they've enshrined, well, it's all the same stuff that we've been talking about, enshrined innovation as the purpose of the state and built these innovation zones and done all these amazing favors for big pharma and for Silicon Valley. And they're, they're the governor, well, it's a long, 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 long story. So what I tried to do in this was look at how Democrats, when they're completely free to do as they see fit, what they do with that authority. And you can find cases. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, they destroyed his presidency. And it's an awful thing. And you can't, of course, can't blame him for that, although he is president and he could have fought back and he could have been more innovative. And some of the things that I need to shut up. But something like antitrust, they couldn't have stopped him. If he wanted to enforce antitrust in a different way, they can't stop him. The laws are on the books. It's totally up to the president and his Justice Department. If he wants to prosecute Wall Street bankers, they can't stop him. The laws against fraud, we've had laws against fraud in America since day one. They can't stop Eric Holder if he decides to prosecute Wall Street bankers. And there's, you know, other things like that. There's no way, there's nothing the Republicans could have done to stop him. But he chose not to.
So he's been going for many days. What we're going to do is we're going to take two more questions, and then I'm going to let you close it out, okay? So one in the back there, your hand is up, and we'll take this woman down here in the purple right here. Okay, so.
Hi. I just recently completed a PhD at Harvard. I'm a writer now. So I'm sort of interested in this Ivy League aspect of your argument. And you seem to be saying there's a class solidarity component, and then there's a kind of ideology component to it.
Yeah.
I'll just throw out a few kind of counterfactuals there. One is, you know, you've got people like Elizabeth Warren, super critical of the banks, could have been a Bernie Sanders if she had wanted to, very critical of Hillary Clinton on financial regulation. You know, she's like a Harvard professor. You've got, you know, FDR was Harvard, Kennedy was Harvard, the Camelot was the same kind of professional expert class, so was FDR's brain trust. And you've also got some signs that amongst these elite liberal economists like Paul Krugman, they're actually moving away from free trade now, and they're actually critical of themselves in the 1990s. And so I kind of wonder, I'm sort of less convinced by that piece of the argument, maybe more convinced by a more simple explanation, which is the reason why they're for these things is because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
Right? Big Pharma has money, Wall Street has money, why does Obama defend Saudi Arabia? Because they give us loads of money. There's no ideological component to defending Saudi Arabia or other kind of things they do. Is this really that different? Or is this a class thing, or is it just a money issue?
Yeah. It's both. No, it's both. So what's fascinating about all this is that the Democrats' great turn to the professional class started before money in politics became a big deal. It starts in the late 60s and early 70s, and this is well before any of our modern campaign finance problems. And even then, you know, they're choosing an affluent group over a blue-collar group, yes, and these people have more money, but blue-collar, I mean, organized labor is no slouch in the money department, especially back in those days. I mean, the organized labor had a lot of money, and they deliberately turned their backs on them. But it's a happy coming together. As I said, it's a return of the Victorian era. Sort of the money and morality are one again. I think that is a huge part of the story. The thing is, I've told that story so many times, I got sick of it, and I figured there had to be something deeper to it. You know, it can't all just be legalized bribery. There's also class, there's also solidarity, there's ideology, all of this stuff. Can I tell you a story about expertise? And maybe this will be the last anecdote. So the Obama administration is filled with, you know, he comes into office. One of the reasons I really like the guy is because, you know, you're coming out of the George Bush era with its hacks and cronies letting New Orleans drown, these totally incompetent people running government agencies like FEMA. And here comes Obama, professor at the University of Chicago. I used to see him at house parties there. You know, really, really intelligent guy. I really admired him, and I knew one thing for sure about him. He would be putting smart people in charge of the government, and he does. He goes out, everybody's saying, all the columnists are saying, Obama, you got to get the smartest guy in America on your economics team, and that guy is Larry Summers, right? The president of Harvard, the celebrated economist. Well, he also happens to be the guy. I mean, this is a guy who has screwed up many, many, many times. He's single, you know, one of the people most responsible for bank deregulation in the Clinton era, and they put him back in charge. This is crazy. And then you put all of these other, he has all of his extremely well-educated inner circle of advisors, and they screw up, and they screw up, and they screw up. And so the book is, in some ways, Listen, Liberals, a story of it's a meritocracy of failure. And this is fascinating. Like, you know, when I started realizing that's what's going on, it's like, what the hell? How did expert, you know, because I'm a great believer in experts and expertise. Like I said, I got a PhD. I believe in this stuff. How did this happen? And then you look back, and it also happened. There's another very famous example of this, the Vietnam War. The famous book from the 70s, The Best and the Brightest, about like these Harvard political scientists who dreamed up the Vietnam War and like kept us in that war even when, you know, all of these sort of lesser lights knew it was a bad idea. They're like, please stop. This is a stupid thing to do. And they're like, no. You know, the body bags. Look at the chart go up. You know, blah, 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 blah. Disaster. Brought to you by the greatest experts in American society. So I said to myself, has there ever been a time when expertise in government worked? I mean, it's a weird question to ask, right? Of course there must be, right? And there is. There's a golden age of it is the New Deal in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Roosevelt was a Harvard man, and Roosevelt brought in brilliant people from all over America to run his administration. Now, this is the fascinating thing. They weren't all Harvard guys, okay? They weren't all from this monoculture of East Coast meritocracy. They came from all over the country and all different walks of life. You look at Harry Hopkins, his trusted right-hand man, had been a social worker from Iowa, okay? The guy he put in charge of his bailouts was a small-town banker from Texas. He hated Wall Street. He had no hesitation about firing executives in banks all over America, putting banks out of business whenever there was any indication of fraud or anything like that. The guy that he put in charge of the Federal Reserve was a kind of genius, sort of invented an American version of Keynesianism. We didn't know who Keynes was in America at that time, and he invented this sort of domestic version of it. I'm forgetting his name right now, but he was a banker from Utah. I think he went to Brigham Young or something like that. Harry Truman, his vice president, didn't go to college at all. His attorney general, Robert Jackson, you know, again, a great creative mind, was a lawyer without a law degree. This was the prosecutor at Nuremberg, by the way. They put him on the Supreme Court. He didn't go to law school. And right down the list, I mean, even his Harvard guys, John Kenneth Galbraith, you know, this guy spent his entire career railing against conventional wisdom. Remember, that was a phrase that he made up. So that's the Roosevelt administration. It's people from all over the country, all different walks of life. And here's Obama taking everybody from this little tiny class of super high-achieving people. They all know each other. They know these guys on Wall Street. They know these guys in Silicon Valley. They look at Wall Street, and they say, you know, we can't punish them. They screwed up one time. Come on. Besides, they're such innovators. Financial innovation, everybody. Derivatives, securities. It's awesome stuff. They're plucking wealth out of thin air. Oh, to hell with the whole thing.
So, actually, we have one last question.
Okay,
so
one more, and then
it's going to be one short question. One very short question.
Oh gosh.
Very short answer. Because we've hit 8 o'clock.
I want to start by saying that the Democrat that I remember in the late 60s is Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, great man.
And if we hadn't lost him.
Yeah, everything might have been different.
Everything would have been different. I'm curious to ask, when you speak to a group of Democrats about all this, what is the response of the audience?
Well, that's a short answer.
Yeah. A lot of them. I mean, I really don't anymore. I've become persona non grata in America. You don't know about this.
Yeah, but you are here in London. You're going to be speaking to a group of
Democrats. I did this afternoon. Yeah, it was great. They were totally receptive to what I was saying. But that's unusual. Sort of whenever there's been very few reviews of Listen Liberal in America. Very few, and there have been a couple by your kind of Democratic Party figures. They hate it. I mean, what do you expect? They absolutely despise what I'm selling, you know, what I'm talking about. So the other thing, and this is an interesting thing. So I used to be on TV all the time in America. I used to be, you know, like a talking head on TV when I was the man at war with the Republicans, right? And I went after them. I wrote 3 books, you know, trashing the Republican Party and the conservative movement. I used to be on MSNBC all the time, you know. I wrote op-eds, blah, 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 blah. None of it now. I'm never happens in America anymore. I'm never on American TV any longer.
Really? Not even on Fox?
Fox. They know better than to put me on TV anymore. But not even on MSNBC. No, nowhere. Yeah.
Tom, it's been great to have you here. Please join me in thanking Tom. So, remember.